You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Happy postseason, everybody. The 2016 playoffs are underway, and we are anticipating the National League Division Series between the Dodgers and the Nationals. I'm Allison Sutter. Let's talk to the beat writers about and preview the series. We're here with Bill Latson, the Washington Nationals website, and Ken Gernick covers the Dodgers. Ken, I'll start with you. We've discussed many times over the course of the season trying to dissect what kind of rotation this is. I kind of like the way it looks now after this long period of time. Obviously, with Clayton Kershaw being at the top, you can't really go wrong with that. But kind of how do you just look at those top three guys heading into the division series, facing a team like the Nationals?
Well, Kershaw just seems to be getting better and better since he was hurt. Hill has been okay. You know, he was really good when he came back, but those blisters have prevented him from getting into a regular routine. Maeda, actually, his last outing was not good at all against the Giants. So if there's a question mark right now, it would be him. And the assumption is that Kershaw comes back on short rest, as he often has in the postseason. But if he can't, or if he doesn't, for whatever reason, it would be rookie Julio Urias. So that's the way it sets up for this series.
So, Ken, with Kershaw having an abbreviated season and having those 2 months, does that help the situation now being able to bring him back on short rest? I know we discussed this a little bit in the past, but just like now that we're up against it here, the division series, I mean, can that work in his advantage in October to have had not as many innings and time put on his arm this year?
Well, you know, I don't think it's ideal. You know, I think they would prefer, you know, to have four outstanding starters instead of one or two. You know, but I think it's what they consider to be their best chance to win. You know, they've had mixed results in the past. It's not – certainly isn't a guarantee success because they've never made it to the World Series by doing it. So you could make that argument against it. You know, he's – when he's right, he's – pretty much the best pitcher in baseball. So it's hard not to say, well, I'm not going to give it to him. I'm going to give the ball to anybody else. So, you know, he's kind of the automatic default, even though it's not an ideal situation, even though that you're pretty much assured that you're going to have to use the bullpen that second time around because you're not going to ask him to throw 120 pitches on short rest. So, you know, it's the best of maybe a mediocre situation. But it's, you know, with the way this roster stacks up and with who they have to work with, he's you know, it's hard to argue against him being the best chance to win.
Yeah. So, Bill, let's move over to you. With the Nationals rotation, which, you know, for most of the season or for a large part of the season was considered to be one of the strongest in the league, of course, you know, they've had their – there's not a team that really hasn't had any injury issues or inconsistency problems, but certainly – the Nationals rotation still looks good with Max Scherzer at the top, Tanner Roark, who had a phenomenal year. But just as far as being at the strength that it is now, how would you compare that to the season and sort of how do you see it going into the postseason?
The rotation and, in a sense, the bullpen is in a state of flux right now because after Scherzer and Tanner Roark, I mean, it's anyone's guess, you know, if they can get quality starts. After that, you know, you talk about Gio Gonzalez. He has not been good this year. You talk about Joe Ross. He has an injured shoulder. But, you know, you don't know if he's healthy enough to go seven innings. He has yet to go seven innings since he came back from his shoulder injury. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see if Scherzer, for example, will he come back for game four or game five, whatever, because the Nationals have never done that in the past. So, I hope Scherzer can pitch more than the one game, but we have to wait and see.
So a lot of, you know, people that are paying close attention to these teams, to this series, have said that the bullpens could really factor into this. And, you know, Ken, it's interesting because, like, the Dodgers bullpen is actually pretty strong. It's something that we really don't talk about a whole lot, but at the end of the day, it looks like a pretty decent bullpen. Do you kind of agree that that could be a strength of the team heading into this division series?
Well, it sure was to help get them this far when you consider all the problems that they had in the starting rotation with injuries and short starts, and they had to rely so much on the bullpen. you know, and maybe games play out like that here in the postseason, which would make them, you know, give them an edge. You know, on the other hand, they've come into other postseasons in similar fashion, and for whatever reason, that seventh and eighth inning just became kind of a black hole for them. So, you know, this year they have Joe Blanton, who's kind of reinvented himself to be the setup man, and he's done an excellent job all year getting the ball to Kenley Jansen. And they've kind of mixed and matched as far as the seventh inning with Pedro Baez, and now Grant Dayton, the rookie left-hander, has kind of come on in a spot that last year was J.P. Howells, and he didn't even make the roster this year. So they have some new faces, Josh Field, who throws hard for a fifth or sixth inning type guy. Like I said, the bullpen is a big reason why they got this far, because their starting rotation wasn't able to get deep. Whether they can win against this kind of competition this late in the year, getting five inning starts, that's not the ideal way to do it. So it'll be interesting to see how much different the postseason plays out, and whether the bullpen is even allowed to play the same kind of role it played during the regular season.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And, Bill, on the national side, of course, adding somebody like Mark Melancon definitely strengthened the pen. Overall, how do you see the rest of the relief corps and where they are heading into the division series?
Well, Dusty Baker, number one, said a few minutes ago that they're going to carry three lefties in the bullpen. Who they are, we don't know yet, but I'm almost sure Sipchinski is going to be one of them. Sammy Solis is going to be another. It wouldn't surprise me if Sean Burnett made the team as well. So I think the bullpen overall is not what I call a shutdown bullpen, but it's good enough to get out. So we hope that after the seventh inning's over, the bullpen can really be productive.
Yeah, so now that we're in the playoffs, talking about lineups and just depth of lineups and things that definitely carry teams through the long season, that tends to not be the case when you get in the postseason. It's mostly about pitching and defense, how good your bullpens are. But we do want to talk about the lineups a little bit. Two very strong lineups. Ken, on the Dodgers side, I mean, you know, we sound redundant when we say this, but clearly the depth of just the offense really, you know, carried them through the season. So I would imagine the Dodgers feel pretty good about just how that all lines up heading into the playoffs.
Well, they hit the score against right-handed pitching, and they don't hit, and they lose against left-handed pitching. So there's your scouting report. So if I'm the Nationals, I put as many lefties in the rotation, they only have one, and as many in the bullpen as they can find, because the Dodgers haven't been able to figure out how to beat them. And the Giants exploited that, you know, to the extreme the last weekend of the season when they swept them in San Francisco with three left-handed starting pitchers. And they weren't all Madison Bumgarner either. So it doesn't have to be an elite lefty. They've really, really struggled this year. But, you know, they've gotten here anyway. So, you know, they're about a 500 team against lefties, and they're much better than that against righties. Because of that, they feel that offensively they match up well against what the Nationals figure to throw at them. So they're kind of happy about that. And they seem to be, for all the injuries they've had during the year, they seem to be right now healthier than the Nationals. So they feel they might have caught the right team at the right time. Going in, that's how they think. We'll see what happens when the bell rings. But, you know, offensively, they've gotten three or four players with 25 home runs or more, and so they can slug. But, you know, Dave Roberts said really slugging is what he worries most about from the Nationals. So they're not a team that just relies on the home run. They're pretty deep top to bottom as long as everybody's hitting. And for most of the season, they have. They seem to go in slumps kind of all together at once, which is not what you want in October, and it's what happened the last week of the season. So, you know, you can look at it both ways. They do feel like they're catching the right team at the right time, and maybe the Nationals, after watching the Dodgers in San Francisco, feel the same way.
Absolutely. And, Bill, you know, I'm so curious to see. Well, first of all, is Daniel Murphy totally healthy? That's number one question. Number two, they have to feel good if he is. And along with Trey Turner, I mean, this is a lineup that really came together this season. So how do you sort of summarize the offense as it stands now, including the health of some key players?
Well, first of all, Daniel Murphy is healthy. He will start game one, so that's great news. The offense has been you know, above average. There's no question about it. I mean, if you talk to Dusty Baker, he's talked about how all season, how the team doesn't score with runners in scoring position and two outs. That's his biggest thing. So hopefully they can do that against the Dodgers. Everyone's healthy. They have six guys that hit 20 homers this year. And I think they could win, especially with Trey Turner at the top.
Awesome. Okay, good talk, guys. Thank you both so much. Good luck this postseason, and we'll catch up again soon. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here getting you ready for the National League wild card game between the Giants and Mets at Citi Field on Wednesday night. We have MLB.com Mets reporter Anthony DiComo and our Giants reporter Chris Haft both here on the podcast to get you ready for the game. And, guys, you have the last two National League champions meeting in a one-game winner advance, loser go home scenario. It's a pretty even matchup. Both teams 87 and 75 in the regular season. The Mets won 4 of 7 head-to-head. That's why they get to host this thing. But it all starts, of course, with the aces on the mound in this wild card game with Madison Bumgarner going up against Noah Syndergaard. They actually met back on May 1st. The Giants won that one 6-1. But Noah Syndergaard had his own success against this Giants team during the season. So let's start with the matchup, and I'll start with you, Anthony. Syndergaard against the Giants this year, 1-1, a 2.63 ERA. He was great in his last start against them in August. He's kind of the last of these young flamethrowers standing for the Mets at this point in the season. Do you anticipate a big effort from Syndergaard on Wednesday night?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think you can say this about any top-flight pitcher, which Noah Syndergaard is, which Madison Bumgarner is. If he's on and he's able to impose his will and do the things that he wants to do, they're not going to hit him. And certainly the Giants can say the same thing about Bumgarner. That's just the nature of baseball, particularly October baseball, when you have some of the best pitchers in the game going. And I'd say Noah Syndergaard and Madison Bumgarner are both, you know, two of the 10 best pitchers in the game, if not the 5 best pitchers in the game. So, you know, we all know what Noah Syndergaard brings. He can run that fastball up to 101 miles an hour. He's got that slider that he can go 94 miles an hour with, and then, you know, some other off-speed pitches. He can generate ground balls with his sinker, with the best of them. But at his core, he is a strikeout pitcher, and that's what he'll be looking to do, is just keep the ball out of play, shut down the Giants' offense completely. And if he's commanding the ball like he can, if he's hitting his spots, he should be able to do that. You know, that being said, it is a one-game playoff. It is a one mistake could knock you out for the season. So while Terry Collins would love to ride Noah Syndergaard for 7-8 innings in this game, and certainly Collins has a history of leaning on his starters for long, maybe longer than he should, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see them go to the bullpen in the 5th or 6th inning if things are getting hairy, if Syndergaard's pitch count, which can be his enemy at times, gets up there, if he's not as efficient as he wants to be. You know, this is Game 7 of the World Series for both of these teams. They're going to be playing it to eliminate mistakes. They're going to be playing it to make sure that they can survive in advance, regardless of how that comes. It's not about Noah Syndergaard going out there and just dominating. While the Mets would love to see that, certainly they'll turn in another direction quickly if it comes to that.
Syndergaard has had postseason success last year, obviously, in 2015, going to the World Series with the Mets, but not the same kind of success that Bumgarner's had as far as sustained success in the postseason. And Chris, Bumgarner obviously kind of put this team on his shoulders in 2014, and it started with that complete game in the wild card game against the Pirates, a 4-hit shutout. He's been on this exact stage before as far as the wild card game goes, a Game 7 of the World Series where he went the distance as well. Is that one area where maybe he can separate himself from Syndergaard going into this game, just the fact that he's been able to throw complete games in this type of situation?
I don't know if necessarily separate himself from Noah, because I'm sure Syndergaard could, you know, has the potential to throw that kind of, to deliver that kind of effort. What Madison does maybe better than anybody else is treat every game the same. Now, I know that's an awful cliche, but, you know, awfully, you know, overly used, but he is a guy who, you know, he'll approach a, he'll approach a spring training game the same as, you know, a midseason start against a division rival. That's just the kind of athlete he is, his mindset he possesses. And so it enables him to, in a big game like tomorrow's, a critical game, obviously, he won't, you know, the situation doesn't get too big for him. And we really saw that in, you know, in to a considerable fashion in 2014. I mean, you could argue that the Giants, that year's Giants lineup, the lineup they took into the postseason was maybe one of the, not to get too negative here, maybe one of the worst in, you know, in postseason annals to reach the World Series. But as you said, Madison put them on his back. I mean, it's a testament to just how good he was that a team like that could win the World Series.
After you get past those aces, these teams, despite the similar records, are very different in pretty much everything else. Chris, I'm going to go back to you here as I talk about the bullpens a little bit, and I think the advantage there has to lean to the Mets. The Giants' bullpen struggled at points this season. I know they lost 9 games when leading in the 9th inning, including 5 in September. But it seems like when they did go to Sergio Romo late in the season to replace Casilla as far as the closer role goes, it kind of helped to settle that bullpen down a little bit.
It did help a lot. I don't think they would have, you know, Sergio saved 4 games between September 20th and October 1st, 4 straight save opportunities that he converted. And I don't think there's a chance the Giants would not have won the second wild card without Sergio's contributions. So yes, that was a key move there by Bruce Bochy.
And then Anthony, as far as the Mets go, obviously Jay Rhys-Familia is a guy they rode all last year through the postseason. Rode him from day one this season. At points this year, it looked like maybe he was tiring a little bit, but he seemed to keep it going, keep it together all season long. Right to the end, he sets a Mets record for saves. They have arms behind him as well. Does that help Terry Collins? You mentioned he may go to the bullpen early if Syndergaard's pitch count gets up there. He certainly has the weapons to do that.
Yeah, of course. And if you ask Rhys-Familia who's the best reliever on the Mets staff, he won't say himself. He'll say Addison Reed, who has been his setup man all year long and statistically did have a better year than Familia. That says a lot because Familia had a great year, but Reed has really been one of the best relievers in baseball and doesn't get talked about nearly enough. But the move that really solidified this bullpen and that took pressure off both those guys was when the Mets made that August waiver deal for Fernando Salas. That basically shortened it to what every manager wants is a 6-inning game. The Mets have the ability to do that now. Salas has been pitching the 7th inning, lights out for most of August and September, and then you go to Reed, and then you go to Familia, and really, if the Mets get in a tough spot in the wild card game or throughout October, those three pitchers can combine for more than 9 outs if the Mets need them to do that. Obviously not an ideal scenario, but the Mets have a lot of faith in those three, and when you stack them up against those back ends of some of the better bullpens in baseball, while the Mets' overall numbers are above average, might not be top in baseball, certainly those back three of Familia, Reed, and Salas can match up with pretty much anyone.
Both of these teams went through their share of struggles during the season, different kinds of struggles. The Giants had the best record in baseball at the All-Star break, but then late in the season stumbled, second half stumbled. The Mets a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, looked like they were dead in the water, but somehow both these teams managed to get it together down the stretch and get to this point, get to October, and they're both teams with experienced guys who have been here before. As far as the Giants go, Chris, it really looked iffy right up until the end, but then suddenly they get home, they sweep the Dodgers 4 straight, and they needed to take all 4 of those games. What clicked in that final series of the season?
Pretty much everything, Tim. You know, they had not been getting timely hitting, so they started to hit with errors in scoring position. The starting pitching happened a little bit inconsistent, so they had, you know, 3 guys in a row make outstanding starts: Bumgarner, Ricky Tyblock, and Matt Moore. The defense was airtight, and the relief pitching, which didn't have to work very hard in that Dodgers series, also was untouchable. So everything that had gone wrong during that second half slump went well for them in the final weekend. Really, the final, they won 5 of their final 6 games. And during that period, was when you know, everything started to click for them.
And then, Anthony, as far as the Mets go, the injuries never stopped happening, obviously. And you look at this team now, and it's still obviously very banged up with none other than Syndergaard and Cologne. None of the other starters you thought you'd see here are in the rotation right now. But somehow this team never kind of put their heads down, and Terry Collins didn't let them come up with any excuses. And they just kind of put that all behind them and just kept winning games down the stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the real X factor for them was Seth Lugo and Robert Gsellman, who came into the rotation around mid-August and were both just dynamic starting pitchers for them down the stretch. No one saw that coming. The Mets front office, the Mets coaching staff, they did not see that coming. And that's no slight on Gsellman and Lugo, but these are guys who are, you've got a 13th round draft pick and a 34th round draft pick, guys who did not have prospect pedigree coming up. And really coming into this season, if you wanted to point to a trouble spot for the Mets, it was the fact that beyond their great, great starting rotation, they didn't have a lot of depth. They traded away Michael Fulmer and so many other promising young arms last year for their postseason push. And they didn't really know what they were going to do if they had to dip in past Bartolo Colon and Zach Wheeler, who was supposed to come back and never did. Well, all of a sudden, Lugo and Gsellman stepped up and were every bit as good as the Mets could have hoped their regular starters to be. And without those two, they never would have sniffed the postseason.
And we'll certainly see those guys if the Mets can get past this game later on in the postseason. One last thing I want from each of you guys, because it's a National League game and we may see late game moves, pinch hitting for the pitcher and guys off the bench, I'd love for each of you to select a possible unsung hero that could step up in this wild card game. Maybe not one of the stars of these teams, but a guy that's lesser known that could come through with a huge moment in this wild card game to get their team through. And I'll start with you, Chris. Sorry to put you on the spot.
I'm going to go with Connor Galassi, the possible starting third baseman. Eduardo Nunez may still have his hamstring problem. He could be sidelined. And Connor has played some recent games, played a lot of third base recently and done well both on offense and with a glove. So if you're looking for an unsung hero, I would make him my choice.
How about the Mets, Anthony?
Yeah, I'm going to cop out and give you two, both left-handed hitters who could come off the bench. One, you know, if the Mets make a division series, it'd probably be on the outside of the roster looking in. But because the Mets can carry some extra bench players for this wild card game, not needing all their starting pitchers, Michael Conforto could come off the bench and has as much power as anyone in this game, capable of changing things with one swing. And the other guy is a guy who, you know, the Mets acquired last year, played a nice role for them down the stretch, and has been even better when they acquired him again this year, and that's Kelly Johnson. Just had some big hits. I know it's a cliche, but a professional hitter, that left-handed bat off the bench, who really has seen every situation. He's been in so many different ones. He's been in a bunch of postseasons now, and he's the guy where if you need that big hit in a tight pressure spot down the stretch, he's probably the one who Terry Collins calls on first.
It's Mets and Giants, the 2016 National League Wild Card Game, Wednesday night from Citi Field. For Anthony DiComo and Chris Haft, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks for tuning in.
Steve, clearly the Diamondbacks, as we say, won the offseason, which turned out to mean absolutely nothing. And, you know, we've talked a lot this entire season about, you know, what's been going wrong. And I think that we'd have to start with the rotation, both injury-wise and just underperformance. And that, I would imagine, has to be the big thing that we would point our finger if we had to put, like, you know, one reason why this nothing worked this season.
Yeah, certainly, Allison. I mean, it almost started with such a bad feeling when A.J. Pollock fractured his elbow 2 days before the start of the season. It just seemed to kind of... And then Zach Greinke had a poor performance on opening day, and Sheldon Miller had one the second day, and it just seemed like there was very little that happened after that was positive, that changed the momentum in any way, shape, or form. So certainly injuries hurt them, but also just a real underperformance by pitchers that they were counting on to be good this year just ended any hopes early on that they had about contending.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Shelby Miller, because I think that's the most interesting one. We'll get to Zach Greinke in a second. But with Shelby, I mean, this is something that this saga is not over, because they gave up a lot to get him. He is a young guy that they have under their control for a while. So this isn't one of those things where you can say, well, okay, this didn't work out so well, and now we move on. They need to get him right. And I know part of it really did have to do with some random injuries that he had. But there was a lot of talk about the fact that he let the pressure get to him in trying to justify this trade. How do they even begin to address anything when it comes to him?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he's somebody that unless they trade him, and if they were to trade him, certainly they would get their trading at an inopportune time, because his value would probably never have been lower in his career than it is right now, the trade value, that is. So I think with Shelby, it's a big part of it's mental. I think he just got off on the wrong foot and just never seemed to be able to find it. And ironically, you know, you talk about this not being something that just is going to go away. I mean, when they acquired him, he had 3 years of control, and because he spent so much time in the minors this year, he actually now has 4 years of control. So they have him under control for the next 3 seasons after this one. So certainly, unless they want to sell low on him, they're going to have to figure out what it is that can kind of piece him back together. He's shown a little bit better once he came up a stint in the minor leagues, and I think kind of gave them hope that maybe they can he could turn it around there next year.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, because some guys like don't want to be the man. Like, they like to blend in and just do their thing and not have really high expectations. One name that comes to mind is like Jason Hayward. I think somebody even like close to him said, like, the reason why the Cubs are so attracted to him is because he didn't have to really stand out among like a team of stars, and he could just do his thing, and he felt more comfortable that way. I mean, with Shelby Miller, it might be a matter of just having to put a better team around him and a better rotation, so he can just be somebody that nobody pays any attention to. I mean, that could possibly be just what he needs, which is unfortunate, because you don't really know how someone's going to react until they are in that situation. But that might just be the kind of guy he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's unfortunate, because it was out of his control that the organization had decided to give up so much for him. And that puts such expectations and such pressure on him. So, again, that's something, though, that if he wants to be successful here, he's going to have to kind of figure out and get some help with it. So, because that pressure is not going to go away next year. You know, people are still going to be looking for him to be the guy that they gave up a number one overall pick for, as well as Ender Inciarte and Aaron Blood.
AJ, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of like an optimistic person by nature when I read coverage of all the different teams. But as we talked last time about the really top prospects that were coming up to the Padres so that the front office could kind of get a good look at them, I don't know. I think this just bodes well for the future. So I want to focus on Manny Margot, because he's pretty much the one that everybody's watching the most. What are kind of some of your early observations of him? He's clearly a very fast guy. What have you seen from him?
Well, so far, I mean, he's the youngest of the bunch, and it seems like that is not even the slightest bit of a hurdle. He plays the game kind of with this infectious energy that you like to see from a guy his age. He kind of does a little bit of everything. He's as quick as they come. He covers an unbelievable amount of ground in center field, and when he hits the ball kind of seems to jump off his head. He's got a line drive swing. So I think the Padres fans have been waiting a while to see what he could do at the major league level. I know he's only 21, about to turn 22, but they've been waiting pretty much all season. And I kind of would have said, hey, temper your expectations. The kid's only 21. And so far I would have been proven dead wrong. It looks like he belongs here.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. It's got to be, you know, this is a time that they really, I mean, every non-contending team does spend this time looking at some of their September call-ups, kind of having, you know, a tryout of sorts, even though they wouldn't actually ever call it that. But there's other teams, like, I mean, not to call anybody out, but like I was talking to Steve Gilbert about the Diamondbacks, and they don't have nearly as much to really be looking at now to look forward to next year to be feeling pretty good about things. And the Padres, as we've been talking about, I mean, they have really been working in the last couple of years to get into the situation where they do have, they are building. And so I think that they have to feel like next year could be totally different from this year.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that there's an aspect of that that is their own doing, that this year is so different from next year because they opted to keep all these four guys at AAA as long as they did. And part of it could be viewed as a little bit of a hindrance because they've got these four guys who could potentially have roster spots next year. If you ask me, I'd say all four of them are probably going to be on the opening day roster next season, or at least they'll be on the team very quickly. They don't really know what these guys can do yet. The sample size is way too small. Yes, Manny Margot's look good. Yes, Carlos Supply hit the ball hard a few times. Yes, Hunter Renfro is a cannon in right field, but the sample size is just way too small to really know. So while other teams may have gotten the entire September to look at these kids, Padres get 2 weeks, and I think going into spring training, it's just going to be the whole entire roster is going to be a total toss-up. There's going to be position battles. I talked to Andy Green about this. He says there's going to be position battles pretty much across the board. I think Will Myers at first base, and Harvis Solarte at third, and even he could potentially move to second. I think Ryan Schimpf profiles better as third baseman. So it's just wide open going into next spring.
Yeah. So you had a really interesting story about Rule 5 pick Luis Perdomo, and I thought it was interesting. The whole Rule 5 phenomenon is fascinating if you really dissect it, but the fact is that once you pick them, they have to stay on the Major League roster all season, which is often a detriment to the player and the player's development. But with Perdomo, he's made this progress, and then he kind of had like a light bulb moment halfway through. He could really be a part of the team's future. Can you kind of just explain like what went on with him and his progression this year?
Yeah, he could end up being the number two starter next season, which is unbelievable. I'll say one thing, going back to spring training and even the first month of the season, it looked like there was no way he was going to sneak through the season with the Padres. And that was kind of their plan all along, sneak him through the year, kind of keep him under the radar at the back of the bullpen. But he couldn't even, he was having trouble making it through one inning. I know on opening day he gave up six runs in one inning to the Dodgers. And then the front office kind of called down to Darren Falsley, the pitching coach, and said, hey, you need to try a sinker with him. Because his four-seam fastball, his fastball hit 97, 98 miles an hour, but he wasn't getting any swings and misses on it. So they asked him to develop a sinker. And I talked to Perdomo about it, and he essentially said that the players were kind of sitting on his four-seam fastball, and they were hitting it whenever he fell behind in the count. And he says, hey, now they're sitting on my sinker when I fall behind in the count. But they're hitting the same pitch. They're just hitting ground balls to shortstop and ground balls to second base. So essentially what he kind of developed, it took all of one game of catch to develop this pitch. He wasn't even throwing a bullpen session. It was just Darren Balsley and Luis Perdomo tinkering with his grip. And he found a grip that worked for him, and all of a sudden he has this nasty sinker that's kind of gotten him through the season. He's been the Padres' best pitcher in the second half of the season. So he's only 23 years old. I think the plan next year was for him to go to AA, or initially it was. Now, like I said, he could end up being the number two starter heading into the season. So it's a remarkable story. And part of it, you can't attribute everything to the sinker. Sinker's a great pitch. Part of it's his mental makeup. He's the type of kid who, when he gave up six runs to the Dodgers in opening day, didn't really seem to get too down on himself, which when you're 23 years old and you never pitched above single A, that seems to me like that's pretty rare. So it's a combination, I'd say, of his mental makeup and just the fact that he's developed his pitch and obviously has a lot of talent.
Thomas, I don't know, debunk this for me. I always read these press releases, announcements, and, oh, this person has stepped down, or, oh, they've been dismissed. It's all the same thing. They're not coming back. But was this, like, really Walt Weiss's decision to not come back?
Well, just put it this way. If he didn't make it, Jeff Breidich would have made it, and they had reached the point to where they didn't want to continue to work together. So it really didn't matter how it was worded. Walt Weiss decided on Monday that he wasn't coming back, and I think Jeff Breidich had decided that he wanted to go in a different direction also. The working relationship just wasn't good. So basically, however it happened, it was going to happen.
Do we know this? Did we know that they didn't have a good working relationship? I've never heard this before.
Well, it's funny because toward the end, no one would actually say it. And toward the end, every story was like, well, they have to decide if they'll come back. And, you know, we were kind of left to kind of put the pieces out there, i.e., the way I did it was, they were in contention, and there was not even a hint of an extension for him. And, you know, even last year at the end of the season, it was like 2 or 3 days before they decided that they would stay together for another year. So they tried, and they put their best face possible on it, but by the end, it was clear that whatever differences there were between them, and there are some natural differences sometimes between your general manager and your manager, they just weren't going to be able to work together going forward.
Do you have any idea, what specifically? Is it a difference in philosophy, maybe from an analytics standpoint, or just maybe Brightish didn't like his on-the-field moves? Did he not like him in the clubhouse? I mean, do we have any idea what the problem was?
Well, that's interesting because he liked him in the clubhouse, and Walt did kind of help a dysfunctional situation become functional. And if you look at the guys who came in, there were going to be a whole lot of rookies here. They had 12 guys who made their big league debuts this year, and that was tied for a club record. They did pretty well with that. It just came down to literally the working relationship. I mean, to the point that, Walt Weiss wanted more to do with the makeup of the team in the off season, and that wasn't happening. He didn't have really much say over personnel. And I know Jeff Breidich had some ideas about on the field managing that Walt Weiss was like, listen, I like to take your ideas, but I'm running the team here. So it came down to really everything that you could have not go right, it didn't go right. I mean, in the best situations, the manager can consult a little bit with the general manager and maybe even make a call or two on some players, but it was really separate here. I think that if Jeff Breidich has someone that he feels really comfortable with, then I think those things could change. What happened was when Breidich came on, he inherited Weiss, who was hired by Dan O'Dowd. So they did attempt to work together, and I've got to give them both credit for that, because a lot of times when a new person comes in, there's a house cleaning, or maybe the manager decides, hey, I can't work for this guy. They did try it, but it didn't work between the two of them, which is kind of a shame because there are a lot of good things going on with this team.
Yeah, seriously. This bums me out. You knew that because I just felt like Walt Weiss was a nice addition to the team a few years ago, and then he was a good manager, but what do I know? That's why we talk every week, Thomas. You can give me these insights. So my next question is, who are the candidates to replace him? Do we have a little wish list, a short list, a list that we just kind of make up because of, just speculation?
Yeah, it's more speculation, but as this thing was moving toward an end, the name Glenn Allen Hill, the AAA manager at Albuquerque, has been coming up a lot. He hasn't managed in the major leagues. He did coach on the big league staff for somewhere around 7 or 8 years before going back and managing 4 years in AAA. So that's the first name that's come up, and a lot of it gets back to the comfort level there. Jeff Breidich ran the minor league system before becoming the major league general manager, and a lot of what's happened with this roster, the young guys that are in place, it happened because those guys came through the system. Now, there is kind of a stepping stone between that and being a winning team at the major league level. So there is that question out there. But Glenn Allen Hill's name has come up. Also, Stu Cole, the third base coach, who has been with the system for a long time. I mean, he finished his playing career in the early 90s at the AAA level with the Rockies, and he's been coaching or managing or working at the big league level since 1995. The other name that's an interesting one is Eric Young, senior, of course. He has some managerial aspirations. He's been first base coach here for a while. He worked a little bit as a special assistant with the Houston Astros before coming. Don't know exactly where that stands with him, but he's a guy who's going to be seeking managerial openings. He interviewed here, and he wants to do it. So there could be something for him in the future. For everybody here, you could see them moving up. I think the other thing that really kind of gets back to where the Rockies stand, Jeff Breidich will be talking this week with the members of the coaching staff. Some of them he hired, a lot of them he approved. Most of them would probably be back. So no matter who the manager is, the general manager is familiar with certain members of the coaching staff and likes what they do. So even when you look at it that way, a lot of people will say, gee, it's a lot easier to promote from within if the general manager likes the makeup of the coaching staff.